Welcome to our podcast. This is Friends on Fire.
I'm Mike. I'm a lifelong devotee of financial independence. I even wrote a book about it.
And I'm Maggie, a newer convert, but just as passionate, especially on the intersection of minimalism and financial independence. We're one and the
same. We are two like-minded friends who believe that talking about money with your friends and family opens the door to financial well-being.
The Friends on Fire podcast is about dispelling myths, building financial acumen, and sharing your financial independence journey with the people you care about.
This is Friends on Fire.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Maggie.
Hi, Liz.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I literally woke up this morning. I was like, it's Friends on Fire Day. I was so excited.
Well, I woke up this morning and said, rabbit, 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 because it's September 1st. And then I saw you posted rabbit, rabbit. What's with the two? I was always taught rabbit, rabbit, rabbit when I was a kid.
I never knew it was three rabbits. I've always said two rabbits. And now I'm worried I've been doing it wrong for a decade.
No, I worry that I've been doing an extra rabbit for my whole life.
I have never heard of this before at all.
I don't know where it came from, but ever since I was a kid, my mom taught us the first day of every month, even if it's like midnight the night before, the first words you say that day have to be rabbit, 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 or in Liz's case, rabbit, rabbit. And so choose your number of rabbits that you'd like. And that's like good luck for the month. And yeah. It just gives you good luck for the month. I don't know where that comes from.
I think I have an idea that it's from the UK, that maybe it's British. Huh. But I posted I woke up this morning and I whispered into my pillow, rabbit, rabbit, just because, you know, I don't want to jinx it.
I know.
But then someone responded on Instagram and said, oh, I read that in a Babysitter's Club book when I was a kid and I've done it ever since. And I was like, that's probably where I got it.
That's interesting.
Which would also explain why I have never heard of this.
You didn't read Babysitter's Club growing up? No. Oh, they're so good.
So good. And they're still classics. It is a superstition found in Britain and North America. I was like doing a little bit of Googling. According to the Farmer's Almanac, the phrase goes back to at least 1909, when a British periodical featured a girl who said rabbits on the first day of each month for good luck. Still unclear whether it's rabbit, rabbit or rabbit, rabbit, rabbit. There seems to be two schools there. So they're both good. But I don't know, this morning, I miss it most months, to be honest. I'm up late and talk and forget or whatever. And this morning I actually opened my phone and the first text I had was from my mom to me and my brother saying, so it reminded me because I hadn't talked yet. And I was like, rabbit, rabbit, rabbit. So
that's so sweet.
Okay, let's get back to, I'm not even on our show notes anymore because I'm now Googling rabbit, rabbit, rabbit. Okay, let's do, now that we've established rabbit, 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 and in true Friends on Fire fashion gotten off track, let's actually introduce.
Or down the rabbit hole, you might say.
We are down, very nice pun. We are down the rabbit hole, and we are down the rabbit hole with Liz, also known as Liz Gets Loaded. I'm going to give a quick intro, and then we'll jump in. We are so excited to talk to you. So you self-describe yourself as someone who likes to drink wine, likes to spend money, and likes to max out your tax-advantaged accounts.
Yep, those are my three main hobbies.
I love that intro. You like keep it short and sweet. And so, you know, what I love about you is you are a regular person, and I mean that with as much that's meant to sound complimentary for what it's worth. And you also describe yourself as vaguely good with money, but a few years ago, Liz fell down this rabbit hole, which are your words, by the way, not mine, from your intro. It's all coming around.
We planned this whole thing.
I know. Where you learned all about tax advantage accounts and the magic of broad-based index funds. And now through the power of investing, plus the privileges that come with being a DINK household, which is double income, no kids, early retirement is well within reach. Liz also started out with a very pretty spreadsheet and then created an Instagram account to connect with other personal finance nerds. And now she has over 13,000 followers on Instagram, a podcast, and a recently launched blog. And ultimately, I think you describe yourself as loving to nerd out about money with smart people. So that's what we're going to do tonight in this discussion.
That's all true. It's all true.
Yeah. Well, welcome.
So Liz, should we refer to you as Liz or Miss Gets Loaded? We can keep it formal.
Or just loaded. Just Gets Loaded.
Yeah, my friends call me LGL. No, Liz is great. Okay. Thanks for checking. It's It's important to call people what they want to be called.
So when Maggie and I first started this podcast, like episode one of Maggie's objectives was like make friends with people on the internet. That's kind of how she referred to it. And you two have become like best internet buds. You talk all the time. You tag each other in your posts.
You slide into each other's DMs.
All the time. She talks about you all the time. And now this is the first time
we quote you on the show like once a month for sure, at least.
Maggie quotes you all the time and talks about how much she likes you. So this is like a special moment for you two, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. I was so excited this morning to meet my friend live. I mean, Mike, I really like you too, but you don't spend as much time on Instagram.
You don't need to patronize me. It's fine.
Yeah. No, if you actually were on Instagram, you guys might be fast friends too. It's just I'm the one behind the Instagram account most of the time. So
yeah.
Right. I don't remember as clearly what your kid's hair looks like, so the bond is not quite as strong.
That's fine. Miz gets loaded.
It sounds the same.
I know, it sounds funny when you say that.
To even catch.
I know, Miz. Sounds Miz. Like the Miz.
So we like to start all of our interviews with talking about childhood. And we ask this question pretty consistently and we get interesting answers. And it's a good way to kick off the discussion about your life and your attitudes about money. So can you tell us how you were raised financially and how you think that impacted your current views on money?
Yeah, I knew that was the first question because I'm a big fan of the podcast and I listen to most of the episodes. I referenced something the other day to Maggie, actually. I was like, oh, like Mike's jacket that he got on sale. And she was like, what are you talking about? I was like, episode 2 about the jacket.
It was impressive. She's a better cataloging of our episodes than I do.
Nice. It was more recent, I think, for me. But my parents and my financial upbringing. So first of all, my parents are the most lovely two humans to just ever be on the planet. And they, you know, couldn't have asked for two better parents. In terms of money, a couple of things. One, I think that they're kind of the classic like millionaire next door, right? So they generally behave very frugally. They always drove like very old used cars. We're generally kind of like looking for things from the clearance rack, et cetera. We didn't talk about money a ton, but my sense was always that on the flip side, you know, they would pick up the check for like a big family dinner. You know, they always demonstrate a lot of generosity. So my hunch is that they're secretly fabulously wealthy and just choose to still shop the clearance rack at Walmart for clothes because they just prefer that. My parents, they gave me kind of two good lessons and then like one real gift that I think set me up for success. One, they gave me some like classic good advice. Don't have credit cards. They're a scam. You know, don't carry a balance on credit cards, as it were. And then also save 20% of every paycheck. And I remember this conversation so vividly. I was like, every paycheck? And the answer was yes, every paycheck. Yeah, and you know, I was like 15. I was like, but I don't need to save money. I just need to like go to McDonald's and like put gas in my car. But so the saving gene came early. Both of them had jobs with pensions, so we never really talked about investing and saving for retirement. I think that just was something that was always taken care of for them. But when I think back on it, I think the thing that they did that if they hadn't done this, my financial future would look completely different. And it's that we had internet in my house from a very young age. And like, I'm an elder millennial. So like I was born in the 80s, but we had like Prodigy when it first came out. So when I was pretty little, we had internet access, which is not that common for like people generally kind of our age group. And I think I just learned really young that if you don't know what to do, you Google it, or we didn't even have Google then, but like you go online and you search for it, you find a message board, you find a website. And so when I was in my early 20s, like, of course, I was like, oh, how do I make a budget? I Googled it. Like, how do I track my finances? Like, I've been using Mint, you know, almost since the beginning. And so I think just that kind of like level of internet savvy made me think like, oh, yeah, I can figure out how to make a budget. I can figure out how to do a mega backdoor Roth IRA. Can't say it, can do it. I think that's just like the skill that maybe not everyone has of like, oh, I don't know how to do this, but I can go online and figure it out.
Yeah, I love that attitude of just that you can figure anything out. It's a great skill and lesson. So with your parents, you mentioned that though they were very good with money, it sounds like. And like you said, probably the classic millionaire next door. You didn't talk about money a ton. Our big thing is talking about money and the value that can come from that. As you've gotten older and you, do they know about Liz Gets Loaded, by the way? Do they?
They don't.
Oh,
they don't.
That's fascinating. That's a whole nother topic, but.
I don't know. Maybe they do now. You two's podcast a lot bigger than mine.
But do you now have more open discussions with your parents about money? Like, do you have a better sense of like how they're set for retirement? And
we dance around it. I'd be curious to know if you two talk handily. I feel like I'm we like, do, hey, yeah. are you ever going to like need anything? And they're like, we're set. Like, we're all good. And sometimes they, you know, of course, I know this isn't the dynamic in all relationships, but my parents will still try to like pay for my groceries when they're visiting or pick up the check. And I just want to be like, I make a lot of money.
Yeah. Like, I know.
I'm fine. You don't need to buy my groceries at Trader Joe's, but like, thank you.
I feel the same way, but I think it also makes them very happy sometimes to do that. Especially,
which is why I always let my parents pay for stuff. I'm doing them a favor.
Yeah, I let them, but you know, I gotta like get my elbow in and try at least. That's our dynamic.
Yeah, I like it. But no, to answer your question, yeah, I've had very open discussions with my mom about money. I wonder if my dad was still alive, if he would be as open. But I mean, she's like turned it all over and been like, tell me what to do with this. And here's where I mean, I know everything about my mom's finances. Whoa. Mike, do you know about yours in detail, like your parents?
Of course.
I don't know. We really? Talk high level on the show. Oh, we've had your dad on. Okay.
Yeah. Don't you think that like one early retiree like would
I think so, but you never know. Some people are still like a little, you know, private about the specifics of things. So
no, we've always talked in depth about money.
Okay.
And my dad like conveyed that information was private, but like he told me how much he made when he was working. He told me kind of like roughly what his net worth was, but he made it very clear that this was extremely private information, right? And that all personal finance is personal. And then we still talk about it today. Like we talk about his sources of income, his taxes, we talk almost, you know, every other day about investment strategies and what we're doing in the market.
So
like, but it's more of like a hobby for us than like, let me share this information about my life.
Yeah,
it's more just a shared interest.
Yeah,
that's nice. So cool. That is, see, you didn't need to go on the internet and make money friends. You just had a built-in one with your dad. That's so
he's
cool.
Had one his whole life. No, it's funny, we have not yet done a topic specifically focused on like talking to your parents about money, but it has been on our list for a while. And this is reminding me it's an important topic, because I do think, I mean, it's different when your parents, Liz, are like, don't worry, we're set. But a lot of people's parents aren't. And so I at some point, I think I've said this on the show before, I actually think it's your responsibility. Like if my mom needed my help at some point, I think it's her responsibility to be open with me so that I can help plan for that and know what I'm, going to be expected to help with in 10 or 20 years or whatever it might be. And so I know it feels like kind of a reversing of tables of like who's kind of quote in charge. But there's a point where I think, you know, there's a lot of value in having those discussions with your parents in the same way that you want to have them with your kids. So,
I think you're spot on.
Let's move on. I know I was also fascinated that your parents don't know about Liz Gets Loaded, but tell us how, because we know you blog anonymously as Liz Gets Loaded. What inspired you to start that? And I love the name.
Thank you. I thought I wanted to go with a less personal name, but then once I came up with Liz Gets Loaded, I have to say, I was like, I love that. It's so good. I was so happy with myself. It's alliterative. It's, you know, it has a double meaning. You know, loaded could mean booze or it could be money. I'm just really happy with it. I feel like I need to go register Liz Gets Loaded on like every platform there is, because I'm so afraid that someone's going to take it right on some platform I don't care to be on. But your question was what made me start. I mean, I think, you know, I joke, but this is kind of also real. Like, you kind of fall down a rabbit hole far enough where you're so into your finances and you have your color coded spreadsheet and you have your projections and you have everything. And then you get to the boring middle where there's not really anything left to optimize. There's not really anything left to learn. And then you just have to create an Instagram account. Like, I think it's the rule.
So Liz, I totally get what you're talking about, where you kind of reach a point where you need to kind of like expand to keep yourself passionate about the topic. Can you share with us, like, what is your underlying reason for all of this? You know, your why for Phi?
Oh, that's a good, I thought you were asking, I'm going to answer both questions that I thought you were asking. So my reason for wanting to reach financial independence, I think about that a lot because I actually really enjoy working. I think that's one of the reasons I relate to Maggie a lot. You can have a job that you love, but also want it to be optional, right? You can be really passionate about your career, but also
be tired
at the same time. Yeah, be tired and acknowledge that it has stress and it has impact on your life. And, you know, it can have pros and cons. And so I just want to, you know, I really want to get to the point where work is optional. I'm to the point now where if I didn't like something, I could certainly walk away and have a pretty good runway before I needed to find something else. But I mean, what joy and freedom do you get from just knowing that like your job is 100% optional and you absolutely do not need it? And if someone crosses you, you can just be like, peace, I'm out. But I thought originally you were asking like, what's the objective of having an online presence? Because it's not really, like, I think for a lot of people, the objective is making money. And I've made, I think, like $42 on the podcast. I think I've made maybe $100 through like upside referrals. I mean, it's certainly not, if the objective was making money, I'd go drive for DoorDash or something and have a much better result than what I'm doing now. And I think it's a couple things. One, you know, connecting with other people, right? Like, you know, I love that I get to like nerd out with Maggie during the day and kind of say like, oh, this is what I'm doing with my account. I'm like, oh, this is how Social Security works. We were just chatting today about like how Social Security gets calculated. I don't have a lot of people in my life who want to talk to me about how Social Security gets calculated. But the other thing, and I bet both of you can relate to this, is the benefit of having, I like to call it the brain trust. Like when you have some number of followers on any platform and you can just post out like, hey, where can I find white linen pants? Or like, what should painting my house cost? Like, can anyone tell me? And you kind of immediately can access some people who are willing to jump in and tell you what they know. I mean, I think that's pretty priceless.
Priceless. I was just thinking as you were saying that, I was like, I totally forgot and I should have worn it, but you were the one who recommended the white V-neck, the white and black V-neck shirts on Amazon that I love. I wear them all the time. You might have seen one posted last night in a story that I wore last night. They're like my favorite shirts. And right, I never thought to buy clothes on Amazon, really.
Oh, man. I need to stop buying clothes on Amazon. I'm trying to spend less money at Amazon. Like, I'm tracking it, right? I can't remember the numbers, but like something like last year it was $3,000 and my goal this year is $1,500, something like that. But those
on clothes
those
on Amazon or on
no, just all total spending. Total spending on Amazon. I'm trying just
rein it
especially
in.
During the pandemic, we locked down pretty hard. Like, I didn't even go to the grocery store until I had both vaccination shots. So it was just very convenient to shop online. But now that I feel empowered to go into an in-person store, I'm trying to divert that Amazon spending into ideally local businesses. But at least in my mind, like even Target feels better than Amazon. I'm at least like spreading my money out in the economy a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So you have shared pretty openly that you want to retire in 5 years. And you said that about 3 years ago.
I know.
So if anyone was counting, you're about 2 years away. And you also mentioned what you just said, and you've said it many times, that you do enjoy working, right? It's not like you hate your job. What is your kind of current thought and plan? Like, what's going to stop you? What's going to accelerate you from actually like taking the plunge? Or do you just like knowing that you can?
That's a really good question. And yeah, I love to say that, like, I'm going to retire in 5 years, but I've been saying that for 3 years. And every year, just like, no, 5 years from today. No, 5 years from today. One more year. Exactly. One more year. I think just getting to the number, and I haven't really changed the number that I said originally. That was somewhere 25 to 30 times my annual expenses. And I was like, okay, this is my number. This might be a slight rabbit hole, but, you know, Mike's so good at editing. So the thing I haven't changed about that number is that last year I bought a big house and I didn't change the number, even though like my mortgage went up a lot, like doubled, because in my mind, I thought, well, I'm buying this house that's big enough for the two of us to both work from home. And when we retire, we won't live in this house anymore. It's too big for two people who are retired. We don't both need home offices. And so I sometimes get in this like weird, terrible anxiety loop where I'm like, am I just working to like pay for this house so I have a place to work? So I'm like working to have a job to pay for my very luxurious home office. That's really silly. But I do still think that we'll move out into a smaller place. So that would be thing number one. Like I would have to get to a point in my life where I was no longer like heart eye emoji for this house and I was willing to move out, or I would have to save. It wouldn't be 3 to 5 years. It'd be like, I don't know, more than that.
Okay. I was just going to say, you're not alone in your loop of, am I just working more to have money to have a nice home office? I mean, that is the spirit of like lifestyle inflation and keeping up with the Joneses. And, you know, it's a version of that in some way.
I think that's everybody's life. They just, some people don't realize it.
The wheel, right? They're the hamster wheel they're in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they enjoy it, to your point.
Yeah. Right. But everybody, like, they spend money on things because they don't have time because they're working. And the more they work, the more money they earn, but the less time they have, and it costs more to go buy these conveniences. And so it is exactly what you're talking about, Liz. I think you are one of the few people that recognize it and have the opportunity to perhaps take a step back and change your lifestyle to modify it.
Well, and even saying that you're like willing to sell your house when you're not working, because you're like, why? Well, I recognize at that point I won't need this much space and it won't be worth the financial burden.
Right. Well, that was the original plan. That was one of my justifications when I like went off the deep end and bought a house that was far above the budget I had set for myself. But now I'm like, but I love this house and I don't want to move out. So I guess I'll just keep working. I don't know. Like as long as I like working.
It's funny. I think there's a middle ground. I arguably have a house that is much larger than I need. I mean, I think Mike, you could say the same, right? We both could live in houses that are half the size comfortably by, you know, the standards in many parts of the world, and or even, you know, a quarter the size. We're going to go off that. But I can afford it. And like Liz, you can afford it. And it's not inhibiting in a big way your goals. And again, maybe, yes, it adds a year to you working or something, or 2 years or whatever it is. But it's a small trade-off in the grand scheme of things for a home you enjoy in an area that you enjoy. And so I think, you know, those are all the trade-offs that people are often making. So you don't, but to sum that all up, you don't have like clear plans of kind of when you're going to retire. Are you just sort of taking it day by day and seeing how things go?
Yeah, I think it depends on how the week goes. Like, you know, some weeks, I don't know if you remember having a job, Maggie. I know it's been a while.
I do, yeah.
But some weeks Rusty. You're like, all right, I think I could wrap it up here soon.
Yeah.
I think I could be done. And then sometimes you get to work on really meaningful things with like really smart people. Yeah. And you think, why would I ever not want to do this? I'll add to that, though, another reason that, I mean, for me personally, that I think that this is so important. I just think about sexism and ageism so much. And there probably becomes a point in my career, whether I like it or not, that I become a lot less hireable in the kind of roles that I want than I am now.
I think that's fair. And I had that thought very often around like, I'm in my prime. Now's the time. Mm-hmm. But I also could fully relate to your comment earlier, or kind of joke/serious on like by the week, right? Like there would be sometimes by the hour. I mean, Greg got to the point where I think he was like, I need you to make up your mind about something, because like, you know, one day you're like, I can't do this anymore. And the next day you're like, I love my job. I'm so thankful to, you know, and it does, it's this roller coaster of emotions based on a lot of different circumstances and kind of how they're playing out on a given day. And I know for me, I finally had to kind of make a plan. And I think Mike, you pushed me on this too, to like put some things on paper to say like, you know, well, what, all things being equal and knowing that it is a constant roller coaster, like what is my goal? And, you know, what are my plans? And what would, you know, perfect look like? And I remember even writing down at one point, and it was this year, it was in 2022. I mean, I said this in 2021. I said, I'm going to ask to go to 3 days a week. And if they say no, I'll leave. And that was kind of my like I got to keep pulling further back. And I never even got to that. I remember one time my current boss making just a side comment, nothing official. I knew if I put someone's feet to the fire, they might do it, but making a side comment about 3 days not being an ideal scenario for me. And I wasn't even asking. It just kind of came up in some conversation, and I sort of stuck in my head, and I was like, yeah, probably not for me either. Like, zero would be better, you know? but it was helpful to kind of like put some mileposts down on paper at some point. Okay. There are a few financial topics. I say a few, there's probably a ton. There are some financial topics we know you are super passionate about that we want to dig into a little bit.
All right.
Some of your favorites. Let's start with charitable giving, which I know is a big one for you. And you are, just to compliment you too, you know, you talk about effective altruism and charitable giving and a number of related topics with a lot of transparency and openness that you don't see as much of in the personal finance space or in the FIRE space. And so I would love to just kind of hear your take and approach on this personally and what's influenced you. You mentioned that your parents were demonstrated a lot of generosity, but just kind of what are your thoughts and how have you gotten to that point?
Yeah, thanks for saying that. I'd be curious if you two feel like you noticed the same thing, but I think there's so many people online who will tell you, this is my salary, this is my 401k balance, this is, you know, every takeout meal I bought in the last year, but they still hold like charitable giving close to the chest. And they're like, that's private. I'm not going to share that. And there's just so much less conversation around that.
I think that's 100% true. And probably for a number of different reasons and angles.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason most of us don't want to share like our salary is because we're afraid that someone's going to judge us, right? If it seems really high, like, oh, maybe you don't deserve that, or you're out of touch with, you know, ordinary people, or there's all kinds of reasons, right? And if it's on the low end, like, oh, okay, your skills might not be that valuable, you're not that ambitious, you haven't gotten that far. And I think that same, you know, double
standard.
I don't know. Standard. Yeah. I think the judgment can also cut both ways when it comes to charitable giving, right? It can seem like, if it seems like a high, if I tell you my number and you're like, well, that seems high. Well, yeah, like, good for you out here bragging about how much money you give away. That's not really generous. And then on the flip side, if it seems low, like, you know, someone might say, oh, well, like,
be much more, you make so much money, how come you aren't giving more?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it also depends on where you're giving it to. I think people can be super judgmental about what causes are important to you. I mean, I do the same thing. Like, every time somebody announces that something, like, they gave like $10 million to some football program in college,
oh,
I'm like,
man.
Oh, you could do so
charity?
Much good in the world. Yeah. These are all nonprofit organizations.
I'm just joking, but I'm like, is that actually a charity? Like, that's not what I really think of when I think of charitable giving, but yes.
Now, for all the football fans out there, don't get me wrong. I love watching football. I just do not want to donate a lot of money to football programs that already make a ton of money.
Yeah.
Right. Like, hey, there's still a lot of hungry kids out there. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You don't need your third alternate helmet for this alumni game. You guys are good.
Right. I'm completely with you on that. So I think that's why people don't share, right? And I think especially as a, you know, high income earner is very relative. I think I would say like anyone who makes over $100,000 is like, I would call that a high income earner. And I would put myself in that category. And so I think, you know, I share my numbers. I give $750 a month to charity. That's my goal. I did not hit it last year. I hit like a real anxiety patch and a scarcity mindset, like frozen in the headlights moment. And I did not hit that goal. But this year I'm on track to hit it. And I do, of all the things I talk about online, it's the thing that I'm just the most like, oh, it feels sticky. I don't know if I want to tell people this. And So I'm really passionate about it. But you asked about effective altruism. Can I like just give a little plug for that?
Yeah, define it. And
right. So effective altruism is a movement that essentially centers around the idea that people are obligated to give in a way that does the most good for the most people in the world. And there's kind of, I should have written this down. Let's see if I can remember the three things off the top of my head. So like one, you want to give in a way that's actually going to affect a large number of people versus like a smaller number of people. You want to give to something that's highly neglected is number two. So not where a lot of other people are already giving money. And then the third thing, good job, brain, The third thing is you want to give where dollars make a difference, right? Like where incremental dollars make an incremental difference, not to a place where resources aren't really going to do very much. And so I discovered effective altruism because, again, I live with generalized anxiety disorder, and I tend to get a lot of anxiety about things and overthink things, like a lot of people. And I just fell down a rabbit hole. I say that all the time, and now I'm going to think about you every time I say that.
Rabbit, rabbit, rabbit.
I know.
Every time you say rabbit hole, you have to say, I fell down a rabbit, rabbit, rabbit hole.
Oh, I'm not going to do that. I fell down a just one rabbit hole of searching, like, what is the best thing I can do with my money when I give money to charity? Because I found myself in a position that I think a lot of people are in, where I didn't have a plan. When something sad would happen in the news, I would like chip in $50, right? Like, oh, there was a hurricane. Here's $50. Oh, my friend's running a 5K to raise money for cancer research. Yep. Okay, here's $25. And I always felt like a little bit guilty when I did that, because I would think like, okay, is this the highest and best use of this money? Like, am I giving money to this shelter that, you know, I don't know how they're using it, or like, is there another place in the world where this could be put to better use? And speaking of that, I mean, I think that's another important piece of effective altruism, is it's not necessarily like, is the charity being extremely frugal and efficient with their money? Like, I think there's some websites out there like Charity Navigator and other ones that say, oh, if you give a dollar, like 93 cents goes to programming and only 7 cents goes to administrative costs or something like that. And effective altruism actually says that doesn't matter. Like, if the organization is making the biggest impact in the world and 25% of their budget is overhead, if they need to pay someone $1 million salary to run this organization because that's how they're going to make the biggest impact in the world, like, that's actually okay. Good thing. Yeah. Like, that's what they should be doing, because that's what makes the biggest impact. So that's kind of the idea of effective altruism. And I just, now I'm like all fired up for them.
You know, so the other lens on effective altruism that I always thought was a big piece of it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I may be kind of mixing up some different terms, but this is from The Most Good You Can Do by Peter Singer, which is a really good book. I'm guessing you've read it.
I didn't finish it.
Okay. Busted. Well, I thought it was a great book, but
yeah, I agree.
One of the points he makes in it that always stuck with me, and really I often have been thinking about a lot since I've retired even, is the idea of the most good you can do. And so for some people who might have, you know, a pull to go, you know, dig wells in Africa or go teach English in another country or, you know, do a number of different just education-based initiatives in different areas and communities that could really use it, for that particular person, the most good they could perhaps do is to go to Harvard, get a job on Wall Street, make $2 million a year and donate that money to that organization, because they have a skill set that is more unique and can earn more money than digging a well, you know, physical manual labor, right? Just that's a very simple example. And I always think of that because I often think like, one of my goals in early retirement is to volunteer more. And I've been doing some volunteering already. But I also am like, but I made a lot of money when I was working. And had I just keep doing that, that's where I can make the most money. And then I could donate it to these organizations, right? And they could get somebody else for $10 an hour to do what I was, you know, doing for 2 days.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I think that's kind of the idea of the movement, is to just rethink charitable giving a little bit. And it's not about like what makes you feel the best. It's about what actually has the biggest impact out in the world. So,
yeah. But I struggle with it because I'll be honest, like what makes me feel the best right now is to hands-on be touching, like be at these organizations doing things directly and not working a corporate America job to make a bunch of money. Right. And so I still feel like it's okay, but it makes me kind of question my, you know, the effectiveness of my approach at times.
Well, it's certainly not an all or nothing thing, right? And it doesn't, you know, it's not like you have to choose, am I going to give money or am I going to give my time or, you know, it's a mix for everyone. And that's my approach too. I really love the way I've like dialed in charitable giving in my life. It's something that used to give me a lot of anxiety. And now I feel very peaceful about the choices I made, because I set this budget every month of $750. And that's for two of us, by the way. So I don't know, in case that gives you anybody listening, like, oh, I feel slightly more judgmental or slightly less judgmental. Like, just want to give you all the facts. It's $9,000 a year. And every month, what I do is if I kind of wait for the month to happen, and then anything that like pulls at my sleeve or like pulls at my heart gets a donation throughout the month, right? So if something bananas happens in the news, like I'm like, great, here's $100, right? This awful Pakistan flooding is terrible. Or, you know, everything that's happening in the South with flooding right now as well. If something happens, you know, if a politician does something that makes me very angry, I've got like some money to do some rage giving. I've got money to do some despair giving. And then whatever is left over at the end of the month goes to an effective altruism organization. The one I like is called The Life You Can Save. That's the one that was founded by Peter Singer, who you were talking about. And then I let them distribute the money in the way that like they think is the best across the globe. I don't have time to go research charities. Like they definitely do. So, yeah. So that's my approach. And it leaves room for that like feel good. Like sometimes you just really do, you're so angry or you're so sad and you feel so out of control. Being able to give money is just such a, just an immediate lever you can pull to make yourself feel a little bit better. But then, you know, I try to balance that out with like, you know, this doesn't feel as emotionally satisfying, but I intellectually know that that's out there doing some good.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it feels incredibly good to give your money and your time to good causes. So
nothing makes you feel more wealthy than giving money away, right?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Now, for everybody not watching the video that we're doing right now, Liz totally lit up when Maggie asked her about charitable giving. So clearly you were very passionate about this.
Let's see if she lights up as much when we switch to...
Next topic, Liz.
Okay.
HSAs.
Oh, man.
All right.
Liz, is that my birthday?
HSAs or charitable giving? What if you can only talk about one? Don't worry, we're going to let you talk about both.
Yeah, you get to talk about both. So Liz, can you tell our listeners, give us a reminder about what HSAs are and why you're so passionate about them?
They are magic and they are almost legalized money laundering. They're so amazing. HSAs are phenomenal. So if you're not familiar with what an HSA is, I assume everyone who listens to you probably knows what an HSA is because they're just so well educated by being longtime podcast listeners. But a health savings account is
It's money. Magic money.
It's like a money thing. Health savings accounts are accounts that you can set aside money pre-tax. So money gets taken out of your paycheck before it gets taxed. And then the money sits in there and you can invest it and then it can grow tax-free. And then you can take it out and still not pay taxes on it. It is the only triple tax-advantaged account that we have available to us in the U.S.
And to remind people, to have an HSA, you have to have a high deductible health plan. You cannot have an HSA if you aren't on a certain type of health plan.
Well, just to be like very nerdy and pedantic, you can have an HSA, but you cannot contribute to the HSA unless you are currently enrolled in
that
a high deductible healthcare plan.
Yes,
but you could be on a high deductible plan this year, max it out, and then switch to a different plan next year. And then that HSA money never goes away.
Yes.
Like it never expires, even if you change jobs, even if you change health plans. For your whole life, that money is sitting there.
Yeah. Like I just left my job and moved my HSA from whatever the provider was into Fidelity. And now I have my Fidelity HSA that I'll forever have. And even if every year I don't choose to have a high deductible plan, like you said, I can still keep my HSA. I can adjust the investments whenever I want. And you're right. It is amazing tax advantages. So you have tell us about you have a very detailed HSA tracker and how do you manage? How do you even use your HSA? Because a lot of people, I've never touched mine. I've never pulled any money out.
Yeah.
Are you pulling money out? Are you saving it all for the future?
No, I treat mine like a retirement account. So I max mine out every year and then I don't touch it. And then I save my receipts. So, I mean, that's the other, one of the beautifully magical things about an HSA is there's no time limit to reimburse yourself. I think, so I talk about HSAs a lot, online and offline. And, you know, you two probably know too, maybe 7 times out of 10, when you say an HSA, they're like an FSA, right? And you're like, No, very different. Well, same idea, but very different rules, right? The question is always like, oh, but doesn't the money expire at the end of the year? Or isn't there a time limit on when you can use it? So I do what I would guess that you probably do. You know, I max it out, I don't touch it. And then I save all of my receipts. I don't have that fancy of a system. I just take a picture of the receipt and I email it to myself, and I have a tag on Gmail, and I just assume one early retirement task will be to like actually make, maybe make a spreadsheet with all of the dollar amounts. But
that's, have you literally been, it's literally on my early retirement list to actually get all my stuff organized. I did not know until, I don't know, 6 or 9 months ago, one of our listeners, someone that actually Mike and I work with, mentioned it. I had no idea that you could do backlog stuff. So I always assume like, oh, someday I'll have like some crazy ER bill and I can, you know, pay for it out of that. I did not realize until more recently that I could use it like a retirement fund, like you're saying. And so just like, I paid like $4,000 this past year for some TMJ stuff. And it's like, I have really good documentation on, you know, the payment, the bills, the explanation of benefits, everything else. And yeah, so I am planning on getting all that organized. Right before I left my company, I was like downloading all my explanation of benefits because I thought you needed those. I'm not sure if you just need a receipt or like how much documentation it's going to require. But I was going heavy on like, I got everything just in case.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean,
to get it organized.
I am really impressed with your level of detail. I actually, okay. So like all the caveats, I'm not a tax advisor or attorney, or like I have no special certificates of any kind, but I don't think that you actually need that much documentation because you don't have to submit it is the thing. So unlike an FSA, you don't have to say like, here's my receipt and someone looks at it. You just reimburse yourself out of your account. And if you get audited, you need the backup, but it's kind of like when you file your taxes, like you don't actually, you know, if you file your taxes and you made a bunch of charitable donations, you don't turn in the receipts. You just say, this is how much I gave. Yeah. And then they might come ask you. So you kind of
To have some decent documentation. But you're right. Yeah. Decent documentation, receipts would qualify at some point.
Yeah. A picture of a receipt on your phone, I think, is like more than you need. Yeah.
No, I like it. I am going to get my spreadsheet going, though. So I'll let you know when that actually happens.
Oh, man. I can't wait.
No, HSA spreadsheets. Even that gets Mike excited. So.
All spreadsheets get me excited.
But did you two know about the loophole for like adult dependents or adult, I think it's domestic partners?
I don't know. I don't think so.
So if you are, it's a really niche thing. This is like one of those things where I'm like, I really am smart about money. Like I actually like know some things. So if you are covered on a family plan, but you're not like legally part of that family, you can contribute the family max. And so there's two occasions that that would normally come up. So let's say you had a 25-year-old kid who's no longer your dependent, but you have them covered on your family medical plan. They can contribute the family max, $7,200 or whatever it's going to be in the future, to their HSA. They can do the family max because they're covered by a family plan. And there's no one else that they're like sharing that family max with, right? So same for domestic partners. If you're not married, but you're on the same health plan, like you're both covered under a family plan, so you're eligible to make the family HSA maximum, and you're not sharing it with each other like a married couple would be. Yeah, so each person can contribute the max.
That's interesting. Nice.
Again, Google that before you do it. Like, don't like trust some anonymous person on the internet whose username implies she might be drunk.
I like that. That's your caveat on everything. Is you're like, don't trust someone who implies that they and is actually drinking during your podcast.
Right. I actually meant to grab a glass of wine before we started recording tonight, but then I was running late.
If you need to go pause us, you're welcome to.
It's fine. I can make it.
Speaking of your podcast, you very openly on it and kind of open the intro with you've got anxiety and you've got money and you like to talk about anxiety and money, which I love the, you know, combination of. I'm curious for you to just talk about the relationship between those two things and kind of how it's even evolved over time. And how does your anxiety affect your spending, your future financial goals, just your finances in general?
Yeah. I might go down a tiny rabbit hole because, so it's interesting when you started the question about, you know, hey, you have this podcast about anxiety and money. A good friend of mine, after listening to the first couple episodes, said, oh, I love your niche. Like, I love, you know, your angle. I love the topic you've come up with. And I was like, that wasn't on purpose. Like, those are just the things I talk about. And then after a few episodes, I was like, oh, anxiety and money. Right. Those are the only two things I talk about. Like, that's my... This wasn't a calculated branding decision, but I like it. I think, what is financial independence, but the ultimate emergency savings account, right? Like not only do I have enough cash in the bank, you know, currently I have enough cash in the bank to cover a roof repair or to evict the bats that have taken up residence in my attic, or, you know, to
paint your deck.
Exactly. Oh my God. The house project. Don't buy a house, kids. It's a scam. But so I have like the cash to kind of write out these emergencies, but like the ultimate emergency is like, okay, I'll lose my job. And for some reason I can't get another job, or I can never work, or I can never earn income again. And like, that's what financial independence is. Someone else, I think it was Tanya Hester, who wrote Work Optional. I'm a big fan of hers. And I think she also called, hitting the financial independence threshold is like entrepreneurship for wimps. Like, if you want to go out and start your own business, if you think you want to kind of start this hustle and maybe make it into something, like it's a lot easier if you know that you've covered your living expenses for the rest of your life already.
That's a great term. I'm kind of a wimp when it comes to being an entrepreneur, so I can totally relate. I've read Work Optional, but I don't remember that term. And I love it. Entrepreneurship for wimps.
So as it relates to your anxiety about money, have you noticed over the years, as you have grown your wealth and grown your knowledge and capabilities around money, that your anxiety has been reduced?
Yes, but not as much as you might think, which I think is what a lot of us in this space find. I used to literally, like, if I would mess up at work, I would just like kind of think the way I would calm myself down from like, I'm the worst, like I'm going to get fired, everyone thinks I'm stupid. I would think like, okay, well, like, what's the worst case scenario? I lose my job. Okay. Worst case scenario, we both lose our jobs and we both have like medical issues where we can't work anymore. And I guess we would like move in with one of our parents and we wouldn't end up homeless. And like, okay. And that was my worst case scenario. And now my worst case scenario is like, we'd probably have to like move into a smaller home. Like, that's my... So I think it's getting better because my like worst case scenario spiraling is now much nicer.
A lot better to me. It's actually like a pretty nice life. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, I might have to stop buying Lululemon leggings. It's now my more worst.
You
case
have to
scenario.
Go to Amazon for your leggings.
And, oh no!
I know, tough times. Or you have to buy used Lululemon leggings on Poshmark. You know, tough times.
I have bought a used Lululemon shirt off of.
I agree. I don't want used leggings.
That feels weird, right?
Yeah, too much. It's kind of like buying used underwear because, yeah,
TMI.
But who wears underwear with leggings?
I definitely wear underwear with leggings.
Oh, really? I thought nobody did. Mike, come on! You don't have a chime in here.
I do not wear underwear when I wear my leggings.
I mean, I have, but I find it to be very uncomfortable and defeat the purpose of how comfy leggings are. And Lululemon's ones that are called, I don't know if they still call them this, but one of my favorite pairs, they're like literally called Naked.
Oh.
They feel like you're wearing nothing. They're amazing.
Okay.
You should go commando sometime.
I may or may not ask you to edit this out later, but I probably won't. So being someone who pre-pandemic spent a lot of time in like, going to group fitness classes and like doing group workouts, I just think like most people think that their leggings are like much more opaque than they actually are. And so I don't go out in the world without a second layer underneath of them.
Oh, that's funny. Well, I will say I don't do a lot of like group classes. I mean, I'm usually like running or in the privacy of my own home, but I wear them out in public a good bit. And now people know without underwear.
I've got a couple memories of like being behind someone in Down Dog, and I'm like, oh, I bet you don't know
how
what that looks like.
Those are, yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny.
All right. How are we going to segue to our next question?
So
leggings are expensive. They cost money.
Mike, I'm going to let you handle that segue because that's you.
Sure. All right, Liz. Oh. We have a hard hitting question for you.
Okay.
If we gave you a billboard, what message would it be that you could share with the world?
About anything or about money?
About anything.
It could be anything. If there's things you care more about, then, which I didn't envision there could be, but.
I mean, I think.
As you are thinking about this, we have determined from a previous interview that the rules allow for a headline and a subhead. Okay. If it helps you answer your question.
Mm-hmm. I listened to that. I listened to that. Was what?
Budget girl? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Sarah. I did. Yeah. The first thing that comes to mind, like the thing that I think I want most people to know about that they don't know about would be effective altruism. And so maybe like, you know, thelifeyoucansave.org just as a website, like you should go here and someone more clever than I am can come up with something that's better than just the URL, but it would be related to that. Because I just think like charitable giving, like we talked about, is a really touchy subject. And so I can sit next to someone and bend their ear all day long about why HSAs are magic or the magic of compound growth or any number of those kind of things. I feel a lot less comfortable being like, hey, you know, charitable giving, that like incredibly personal and serious and emotional choice that you make with your money. Like, I think that you could be doing it better. And here's how. Mm-hmm. So a billboard would be like a really lovely way for me to try to communicate that to a lot of people without having to be like so awkward.
Yeah. And anonymously, like letting them consume it, you know, receive it as they wish without, you know, another person standing there waiting for a response.
Right. But it's bananas. Something like 90 something percent of charitable giving in the US goes to domestic causes, when our money goes a lot further overseas, and international causes are probably meet all of those criteria I was talking about in terms of helping more people, you know, dollars make a difference, and they're not already flooded with resources. So.
Yeah. I remember when I was reading, I think it was Peter Singer's book, but it was, I don't know, it was like Rating or maybe it was Charity Navigator or something, but it was giving their view on the best organization that you could give to. And I can't remember the name of it, but it was malaria nets.
Totally.
Mosquito nets. And I remember the time being like, oh, it wasn't like as, wasn't what I was envisioning when I think of like, where you think I want to feel something about where I'm giving my money to. I want it to be towards like women in need or education or just think these problems that tug at your heartstrings.
Mm-hmm.
And not that malaria doesn't tug at my heartstrings, but it's not something that I think about as being incredibly sad. And, you know, there's a massive opportunity with it. And that's kind of the whole point around the mosquito nets. And I can't remember the name of the organization, but
right.
But it is more the point of sometimes it takes me a minute because I'm like, what is my point? But it is more the point around, you know, the most good you can do may not always be what kind of feels like the like, quote, sexiest thing to you. Right.
Right. Right. You don't always get like the emotional payoff from the highest and best use of your money, which is true with charitable giving and outside of charitable giving. Yeah, right.
Anything like, you spend money on.
Yeah. It's not always that like exciting to put money into your Roth IRA, but that in a lot of cases probably is the highest and best used for it. So
I don't know. Speak for yourself. I get super pumped to make Roth contributions.
It's not as exciting as putting money into your HSA, which is really exciting.
Well, the exciting part is when you like update your color coded spreadsheet and then your graph updates after you make it, but making the actual deposit
Hey, on a related ish note, Liz, have you heard of the Seafire SIM tool?
This is real. So I saw you post about it today on Instagram.
Yeah.
And I tapped on the link and then I opened it like in a tab in my browser so I could come back to it later. But I haven't had a chance to look at it yet.
It's really, really fun. And I was texting Mike about it. And I don't remember, Mike's response was like, are you stressing about money or something? And I was like, no, I was like, actually, it was like, I was like, I'm going to spend more money now. Like, it was making me feel better about splurging. Cause I do, there's a little bit of like when the paycheck stops coming in, a little bit of like scarcity mindset, even in the charitable giving category, quite honestly.
Yeah.
I've given less in the last year since I knew I was leaving and since I've not had a paycheck. And that is something I kind of like do have in my budget and can still afford to do. And anyways, the Seafire SIM tool is so cool. It runs a Monte Carlo analysis. Is analysis the right word? Monte Carlo scenario.
Simulation.
Scenario. Thank you.
Something.
Something. And
does some math. Does some money.
It does
stuff.
Some very fancy math. And what's cool is you can like run all these simulations, and then it'll open a bunch of tabs. And so you can keep changing them and you can like look at all your simulations like in a row kind of.
So is it all simulations around like what happens after you retire?
So you put in your it's a probability of whether you'll have enough money. And so you put in your retirement year when you plan to retire. So for me, it's this year. You put in your retirement end year, which essentially is how long you plan on living. you put in the current value of your portfolio, how much you spend annually. You can choose a few things around like how you want inflation adjusted. There's like a bunch of different options. You give the percentage, you can put as much or as little as you want in here, but you can actually put in your social security payments, which is what had me going to like look at Reese what my social security payments were going to be, assuming I make zero from, you know, now until retirement. And then you actually run the simulation and it gives you a bunch of forecasts, but the most important number is it gives you a success rate, right? Out of 121 different scenarios they're running, which is like the market crashes, the, you know, inflation is higher than we forecasted it to be, which is what it is right now. What is your success rate of having enough money to make it until you, you know, are no longer living? And it's pretty cool because you, it just makes you, I think for me, like I had kind of done a lot of this fairly crudely in some Excel sheets, and it's cool to see them running it in a much more forensic way, if you will, and saying like, look, there's like 100% probability that I'm going to be fine, which makes me feel better about increasing my charitable giving right now versus waiting until I see how the next few years go and, you know, some different things.
Yeah, I would love
for
that.
For me, it's given me permission to spend more right now. It's making me feel better about spending the money I have and not having such a scarcity mindset, which I, so big shout out to whoever created the CFIRE Sim tool, because it's a great tool and it's free. But let's bring it back around.
Right.
I mean, I want to check it out. I do think that there's a lot of content out there about like how to get to your FIRE number. Mm-hmm. And there's comparatively much less content about like what you do once you get there, right? Like you're like, something, bond tent, like blah, blah, blah. And you live happily ever after.
Yeah. And just how you feel about actually spending the money you have now and how you spend time. I mean, how you spend your time. I mean, there's a bunch of things, you know, that I am, and I'm not saying like, woe is me and my incredibly privileged state of being that I am now going through and figuring out. So
what would that European vacation have looked like if you weren't experiencing scarcity mindset?
Oh, I actually was not, are you joking? Like that was a high number already?
Yeah, I was joking. Okay. I was making fun of you. Sorry.
I felt like that was my, I could have gone a lot back when I had a job that I would have spent even more on that. But you're right. I thought that was like a pretty good deal for me.
I wanted to go on that vacation. I was watching along from home. Like I wish I was eating ice cream in Germany.
3 times a day. Yeah. And Mike saw it when I get like a little tipsy on vacation too. I just like start buying stuff for everybody.
Oh my gosh, Maggie, I keep meaning to tell you actually, I don't think I messaged you. Oh, it's driving me bananas because I can't remember the circumstances, but I was doing something the other day and I was like, whatever. I was just like hot and in a hurry. And so I just did it. And then I was like, oh my God, I was hot and in a hurry.
You are hot and in a hurry. It's a real state of being.
Yeah.
Poor decisions are made when you're hot, or great decisions. It depends how you look.
I'm pretty sure it was a poor decision. It was just like, whatever, this is good enough. I was hot. I was in a hurry. Like, this is what. Funny.
Was it your deck? Was it like realizing that the money wasn't included in your deck estimate?
No, it was something silly like, oh, we're just going to eat at this restaurant because maybe hot. I was hot and hungry. Maybe
hot
that's what it was.
And a hurry and hangry is also a triple threat.
Yeah, like we're eating at this crappy restaurant because it's just nearby. Like, whatever, this is what's happening.
Well, I don't know how to wrap us up off that point, but no, I like it. I mean, hot, hurry, hangry, it's all good. All the H's.
Well, I can try.
Really? Oh. Go ahead.
Liz, it's been a privilege talking to you. I am super excited that you and your internet best friend got to talk live over video.
She's not classifying me as her internet best friend, to be clear.
Listen, the way it's you two tag each other in social media posts, you two are internet best friends.
Liz tags a lot of people. Come on, Mike.
It's been special for me to see this.
Thanks. So,
Liz, thank you for coming on the show.
I think matching necklaces are up next.
All right, order, yeah. With the half broken heart, yeah. Okay, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. Next time we'll have to actually get loaded while we talk about money.
Deal. So I'll come back on another episode, and because a few episodes ago, you did a whole episode, you ended up talking a lot about the metaphor, the analogy, the relationship between like personal finance and personal fitness.
And Maggie,
you were like, Liz was just talking about this and like it's a whole thing. And so I'll come back and we'll talk about like the high level, right? Like personal finance and personal fitness are very closely related in that in both fields, people tend to like oversimplify, not recognize like the privilege that you get from your genetics or your yep. parents, et cetera, and so on.
Good. I look forward to that. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same time next week.
Yeah. Same time. We'll make it a weekly or monthly session. I can't think of the word. My words aren't coming out tonight. But anyways, thank you for coming on. And yeah, we will put some links in the show notes so that our listeners can figure out where to find you. But I think Instagram is where you've got, you know, a lot of your daily activity. And then your podcast and blog. So we'll put a link in the show notes to all of that so that you guys can follow Liz Gets Loaded. You post great content, so I highly encourage people to follow her on Instagram. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Liz.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Thanks, Liz. Bye.
Bye. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you've been challenged or inspired by what you've heard today, please rate and review the show. You can also subscribe to make sure you never miss an episode.
If you have thoughts or questions, we would love to hear from you, and you can leave us a voicemail or text us at 404-981-3370, or you can hit us up on Instagram or Facebook.